You are listening to the News Project podcast for the week of August 16th, 2021, brought to you by GNAT TV. This podcast brings you these stories. Dorset Church expands. Recycling challenges. Success program expands. And critical race theory debate reaches Vermont.
Under recycling and hauling fees, it says cost for removing and replacing one roll off is $240, and that's for recycling. And then when you go up to the hauling fees for the waste, it's $240. So we're charging for one, and we're not charging for the other, and it's costing us the exact same amount.
In early July, the Londonderry Select Board found itself discussing what to do about the cost of transporting recyclables from its transfer station. The cost of hauling trash and recyclables was the same, but at the moment they were only charging users of the transfer station for trash and garbage. Was this sustainable? The board members wondered. Recycling has been part of the Vermont landscape for a long time now, and the market for recyclable material, like cardboard, glass, or plastics, has gone up and down over time. China is, or was, a big market for U.S. recyclable material, but that market has changed over the past few years. We asked Joe Fusco, the Vice President for Communications at Casella Waste Systems, about what was going on in the recycling business at the moment.
It's not great, but it's not as bad as it was a few years ago. The thing that most people don't understand, and it's perfectly reasonable not to understand it, but recycling is not some isolated little system. It's part of a larger system, a larger economic system, a larger global economic system. So we tend to need to be reminded from time to time that these things that we recycle are commodities, and they have value globally and nationally, and that value fluctuates. Just like anything else in the economy, whether that be pork bellies or wheat futures or anything like that. The big disruption that we saw a few years ago was a change in policy in China. China set standards for what it would accept as imported recyclable material for the amount of contamination that it could contain. And those standards were quite draconian. They were beyond the limits of any existing technology to produce a bale of cardboard, a bale of paper, a bale of plastic with a level of contamination that it was just almost impossible to do. So what that did was it forced a lot of materials onto other markets around the world. And so you had a excess supply of recycled material trying to find a limited demand. And so the price crashed, if you will, for recycling. So we saw commodity prices for recyclables like paper and other materials really just hit in historical lows. And so it disrupts the other part of the economics of a recycling system as well. The amount of money you've invested in capital and facilities and the cost of collecting that material and the cost of processing that material. So you had to make adjustments, and companies like ours and others made adjustments. We found other markets for our material. We weren't exporting a whole lot of material from Vermont, for example, to China anyways. But what that did was have a ripple effect on other markets as well, places like India, places like Vietnam and Southeast Asia. So the adjustments you have to make are, how do we protect the economic sustainability of recycling as well as the environmental sustainability?
We also touched base with Paula Camperman, the outreach coordinator of the Bennington County Solid Waste Alliance, a consortium of 13 towns in Bennington County, whose mission is to reduce the amount of waste disposed in landfills and promoting recycling and reuse. What are some of the challenges facing the recycling at this moment? 2 years ago when we talked, the market at that point seemed to be in a bit of a downward trend at the time compared to a few years before then. Cardboard and plastics and other recyclables were kind of, I guess, piling up and weren't able to be exported for various uses. Is that still the state of things, or has the pandemic in some way or another changed that equation? What's been going on?
Well, a lot of things, actually. Stateside, we had a plastic bag ban and a single-use plastics ban that went into effect on July 1st, 2020, which nobody seemed to notice, probably, except those that were directly affected in the way of getting the law in place for the restaurants and everybody else that was dispensing those items. But it also, the pandemic itself, created a challenge because we have more takeout containers that were in use, much more plastic disposable items that were used to, you know, keep restaurants opening, getting meals out, but not using traditional reusable serveware. So we have a lot of plastic, to-go containers. Like we've got something like this, you know, where it has two colors, black and clear. But the problem is, it's a clamshell, but the black one is non-recyclable as a plastic, but the clear side is. But most people don't know that. They throw the whole thing in the recycling bin. Also is the markets, as you mentioned, steep demand occurred with cardboard. Everyone was at home having everything shipped to them. So, the shipping companies were in high demand for cardboard, and we're, you know, left and right trying to urge people to recycle the boxes that they were receiving the shipments in during 2020 to help keep the feedstock supplies up to meet the demand for all of the shipping that was going on. But so moving forward, we have to think about, you know, finding ways to deal with all this excess waste. Our recycling streams are challenging because there are not markets necessarily for all the plastics that we use. And so much of it is used in such a short time frame. So we have, you know, you bring a plastic bag home or some other packaging, and it's holding its contents. But as soon as it's emptied, it's thrown in the trash because most of it is not recyclable. We have, you know, single stream recycling in this country, specifically in Vermont, but really only one, number twos and number fives are the ones that there are markets for. So these large haulers take everything, but they have to sort out what they can use. And then their markets for the ones, twos, and fives, and number threes, fours, six, and sevens largely are landfilled or incinerated. So that is a challenge. And that is something that is being put upon us to find a way to solve, as residents and municipalities are paying for this recycling that is bringing us to another conversation. I don't know if you saw in the news recently, but Maine and now just this week, Oregon have put in extended producer responsibility legislation that have passed into law now, requiring producers of packaging, consumer packaging, to basically see to it that packaging is recycled, whether it be footing the bill entirely. That means the recycling costs, hauling, getting it back into the recycling stream, and or working with extended producer responsibility organizations that help do that stewardship to make sure that there's a program in place, like we have in Vermont right now with paint care and e-waste and fluorescent bulbs. Those are extended producer responsibility programs in place to get that stuff out of the waste stream. So that's starting just in little bits and pieces, starting in parts of the country now that we hope will spread, hopefully maybe to Vermont sometime, to get people to get the products that we're taking and their packaging out of the waste stream so that it goes back into reusable stuff. So all those pouches that you see that you have to throw away because they're not recyclable, that has your favorite snack in it or something, it can actually get recycled at someday. That's what we hope.
The market for recyclables will probably continue to go up and down over time, but at some point, finding a place to dispose of all the trash we generate will become a bigger problem than it already is. So continuing to find creative ways of recycling and recycling more items will continue to be important. For a deeper dive into some of this, you can watch an in-depth discussion we had with Ms. Camperman recently. You can find it at GNAT's website at gnat-tv.org. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. The Dorset Church, formerly known as the United Church of Dorset and East Rupert, is about to grow. With its membership swelling, more space is needed, So a second story to the existing rear wing of the church is in the works to add four rooms for meetings and storage. An elevator to allow access to all levels of the church building will also be added. A capital campaign has been underway for a while to raise about $1.6 million for the construction, and with $1.3 million in hand, church officials held a groundbreaking ceremony on Thursday, August 18th, to mark the occasion. It was moved indoors because of the weather, but the impact was the same, and plans call for the addition to the historic church to be completed by next spring. Henry Chandler, the church moderator, described what will be happening and why it was needed.
We've been working on this project, I think, 6 years now, and it started when we realized our office was way too small, probably a 10 by 12 room, and we were, you know, we'd have four or five people in there at a time, and it just was causing all sorts of dysfunction. So, and additionally, we had mobility challenged people. Their access was really demanding, in fact, intimidating, if not humiliating. And we knew we had to do something about that. A person had to walk 100 feet, go down the lift for half a story, walk another 100 feet to another elevator that brought them up into the sanctuary. And that just, people stopped coming to church because of that. So we've been working on it really in earnest for the last 3 years, working on a building design and settling on a design, and then doing the fundraising. And once we were comfortable with having enough funds to actually build the building, then we are progressing as of today.
Pastor Jim Gray, who has been the minister of the church for the past 23 years, also spoke to why the addition will be essential to the continuing operations of the church.
Two areas that I'm really excited about. First of all is that accessibility to people who have always had a difficult time climbing stairs and dealing with our ancient elevator system will all be able to access all the levels of the church in one spot, easily and with greater anonymity. And I know that there are a lot of people who do not come to worship or to other events because negotiating the old elevator system was so difficult. So that's the first area. The second area is the possibilities of new ministries that we will use to fill the new spaces we're putting on the back wing of the church. And I think that the sky is the limit for what imagination can come up with in terms of ministry to all generations, to the youngest and the oldest, and everyone in between. So those are the two things that really excite me that will come to fruition. I think we're enough there that I can say that it'll happen.
The church has deep roots in the Dorset community. It traces its founding back to 1784, when what was known as the Lord's Barn was erected in what is now the Maple Hill Cemetery. After a couple of church buildings were destroyed by fire, the current marble building was constructed in 1910. The current rear wing of the church was added in 1974, and now, nearly 50 years later, another addition is required for the rear wing. During the ceremony, Jane Labruto, the church's administrator, gave an explanation of what made this expansion necessary.
Right before COVID, if you called me and said, Jane, could I hold a meeting in the back room? I would have six other people already scheduled to be in there, six other groups. So I want to just say these few words. What did the people of Dorset think about when their beloved church burned down in 1907? Did they think about the future? The answer is yes, they did. That's why they didn't rebuild with wood. They thought about us, and what could be better than this marble building that was built to last? Yes, we have them to thank. They thought about our future, and now it's our turn to think about the future of what this church can turn into. We can only dream. And over the 21 years that I've been here, lots of dreams have come true at the Dorset Church for many, many people.
Construction will be getting underway shortly. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. On Saturday, August 7th, about 30 people converged on the Park House at the Manchester Rec Park to hear from two speakers, K. Carl Smith, the founder of the Frederick Douglass Republicans and creator of the Frederick Douglass Republican Engagement Strategy, and John Klar, a Vermont businessman and a candidate for the Republican nomination for the governorship last year. They spoke on the controversial subject of critical race theory. The theory, first developed by academics in the late 1970s and not widely discussed outside of college and law school campuses since, posits that, among other things, racism is systemic as well as personal, that both private and public sector institutions have operated to suppress and deny opportunities for African Americans and other minorities of color to advance. The theory also argues that historical patterns of racism are embedded in law and that the legacies of slavery and segregation still create an uneven playing field. Critical race theory shot into prominence after the George Floyd killing last year and the Black Lives Matter protests that followed, and in the months since, some have become concerned that critical race theory is seeping into elementary and secondary education curriculums. This point was addressed by John Klar in his opening remarks.
Huxleyan, Orwellian, Anthony Burgess, okay, Clockwork Orange, reprogramming to get rid of the systemic racism we haven't even proven existed yet. They've got a long way down that road in our schools. And 20 legislatures around this country are talking about banning this for the exact reasons I'm talking about. And then we're told, oh, no, no, that's not taught in schools. Yes, it is. Oh, no, that's just right-wing extremists. They don't want to talk about race. Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
In his talk, K. Carl Smith, a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel who lives in Alabama and who was invited to speak at the event in Manchester, along with another in Bennington a few days earlier, pointed out that critical race theory, in his view, portrayed all African Americans as victims and that all white people were racists, which he disagreed with. He also devoted time in his talk to emphasizing the work of Frederick Douglass, a former slave and black abolitionist leader of the 19th century. His approach of promoting dialogue and making alliances across racial and ideological divides was as on target today as it was when Douglass was alive, he said.
When I went through the critical race theory and tried to understand what it's talking about, there are several assertions that they made, this theory now. They make several assertions. I'm gonna cover three of them with you right quick. Number one, that blacks are perpetual victims of white racism. That I'm always gonna be a victim. The devil is a lie. God, I serve is greater than that. I can't help myself. I need somebody else to take care of me. Because I'm a victim. How do we counter that assertion? We counter it based on the writings of Frederick Douglass. Douglass was in Boston. He was speaking to a group of abolitionists. And he said to them, stop treating black people like they're a special class of people. He said, leave them alone. You did not do anything special for the Irish. Leave black folks alone. Because your interference is causing him positive injury. The second assertion that I talk about, that I want to share with you, is that white people are inherently racist and have no redemptive qualities from being a racist. That white people are inherently racist. When I thought about that, I said, wait a minute. If that is the case, why do white liberals get a pass? Why do you get a pass? Inherently racist and have no redemptive qualities. How do we refute that? Let's go back to the writings of Frederick Douglass.
After his talk, we had a chance to speak with Mr. Smith for a few additional minutes.
Don't you feel that critical race theory kind of provides some useful additional context for understanding American history? I mean, the fact that, racism is a fact of life, really since the dawn of the country, really. And even if all the specifics of it, you don't feel add up, don't you feel that it would add additional context to the education a lot of students would receive in school, and also the way people look at our society and how it works? Is there anything positive to it that you feel is a useful addition?
I don't see anything useful out of telling black kids that they're perpetual victims.
Do you feel that's what it does?
That's exactly what it does. I mean, I read the critical race theory myself. I don't think there's anything useful about telling white kids that because they're white, you're an oppressor, and you cannot be redeemed from being an oppressor. It doesn't say that in that language, because the critical race theory is written in a very academic level, but when you really look at it and understand it, and talking to students who've got the training, that's what they're coming away with. So I don't see anything positive out of that, because you're creating racial strife and animosity between blacks and whites. That's not good. And to me, that overshadows. If anything positive can come out of critical race theory, I don't know what it is, that overshadows it in my book.
Well, the original theory, as I understand it, maybe you know it better than
it's
I,
a theory.
Was
okay.
A theory that was our first developed in the late 70s and early 1980s. And I'm sure you would agree that there was racism and racial disparity in this country before the late 1970s.
Yeah.
So why would critical race theory be responsible for teaching black kids that white people are all oppressors or whatever?
Look, it's not true. My children are not victims. They're more than conquerors, and they get that from their faith. When Frederick Douglass, even though he was a slave, he never had a slave mentality. He didn't have an oppressed mentality. He always saw himself as an overcomer. That's why he ran away eventually. So what I draw from the critical race theory is that when you tell someone that you are a victim and you need help and you can't help yourself, then therefore you're left up to the instructions and social benevolence of somebody else to help you. And don't rely on God to do it. Rely on the leader. Rely on Fidel. Rely on the government. Don't rely on a God. That's the problem I have. Totally removing God out of the scene.
But the point of whether critical race theory is or is being planned to be taught in Vermont schools was debunked by Vermont's Secretary of Education, Daniel French.
I think it's important to acknowledge that this is the critical race theory activity is part of a coordinated national political movement addressed at local school boards, essentially, and it's a political activity that has caught a lot of national attention, more so in some states than others. But this is not a organic Vermont sort of concept. This is part of a national, coordinated, well-organized national political movement. And I think, every Vermonter should be firstly somewhat suspicious of any question that says we have anything centralized and well-planned in our education system. So every Vermonter knows that our system is highly decentralized, and that is one of the great strengths of our system, and that's local control. But just to sort of describe from a curriculum perspective, which is, I think, the central thesis of some of this activity, Vermont does not have state-level curriculum. At the state level, we prescribe curriculum standards, and that's done through the state board, and it adopts standards, and often those are enforced through regulation. But then local school districts, not schools, but school districts are responsible under the law for developing curriculum and coordinating that curriculum. It has to be aligned with state standards, but their charge at the local level is to coordinate that curriculum among their schools. So curriculum, there's no state level coordination or conspiracy around promulgating CRT. it's CRT, you know, from a technical standpoint, is not a curriculum. It's a theory that exists essentially coming out of the law school concepts of looking at institutions and so forth from a critical perspective of racial justice. That's not a curriculum. It's not specified in our standards in any way. So, you know, the first thing I would say, if parents are interested in the topic, and essentially, you know, that's what this political activity is pointing to go to school boards. They're not inaccurate in that regard, because your school boards are the folks in Vermont who have control of our curriculum ultimately. And it's a great conversation for people to have. Parents, citizens, everyone should understand what curriculum is being offered in schools. But you know, again, this is a national political activity being well coordinated and orchestrated. This is not, from my perspective, coming from someone who understands what's going on in Vermont schools, and they're calling this out as a problem. For the most part, I don't think these people are very familiar with what our construct is in terms of curriculum, or actually what's going on in Vermont schools today.
The speaking event was hosted by the Rutland-based nonprofit organization Vermonters for Vermont Initiative and the Vermont Liberty Network. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. The Success Program at Burn Burton Academy, begun in 2012, and which aims to help students excel in high school and plan for their lives and careers after graduation, has been so successful that it's been adapted for 7th and 8th grade middle school students by the Taconic and Green Regional School District.
We have a couple of things that we need to address. Step one, everyone turn and face the people behind me and wave enthusiastically.
For a couple of weeks before the start of school in the fall, students who will be taking part in the Taconic and Green Success Program have been meeting and getting to know one another, such as through gatherings at the ropes course area behind Burn Burton. That's where we caught up with this group of students and mentors who are going to engage in some team building exercises.
Let me see you hug yourself.
Ready to fall.
Okay. Hands up like mittens, Manny. There you go. You say ready to catch.
Fall away.
Fall away. Good job. All right.
Serena Borowski is the director of the Taconic and Green Success Program, and she explained what was going on.
So this is the first Friday of the 7th grade program, the Taconic and Green Student Success Program. It is a 2-week summer camp for 7th graders to work on their social and emotional preparedness to go into middle school. So what they're doing right now is a big exercise in trust and communication with one another.
So this is the first time around through this whole program for everybody?
For the 7th graders, yes. We actually just completed our 2-week program for the 8th graders last Friday. Taconic and Green was started as an extension program of the BBA Success Program. So we work with 7th and 8th graders who then will hopefully, if BBA is their school of choice, move on to be in the Student Success Program here at BBA, which focuses on academic preparedness. They're also just generally speaking a group of kids for whom school has not always been 100% comfortable or welcoming environment. So success is meant to stand in as another community for them within the school where they do feel comfortable and act as advocates so that they can more integrate into the school environment.
The ropes course has several stations where students have to solve problems and need to work in groups. One of them was figuring out how to get from one platform to another without touching the ground.
I'll walk across, jump to here. Someone can jump to there.
I made it.
You jump to there, and then you take this, do the same thing.
And then you can do this plan.
Like this, and then...
I'm pretty sure someone... Wait, here. Can I... Look. Wow, that actually
would
work.
Hey,
can you...
Okay.
Another was a spider's web that the students had to navigate without touching the ropes.
I'm good.
Yeah,
come
closer, man. I'm
pajamas.
Oh,
another snake
ball.
Oh,
he touched it.
I'm not touching it. I can't control that.
You're flailing your arms.
Shay Mokler, a junior at Burn Burton, is one of the student mentors.
So coming into BBA, I was struggling quite a bit with social anxiety, so I joined the success program for freshmen. And Jason Pergamon and Billy Canfield helped me so much and introduced me to the Taconic and Green Success Camp, and I really wanted to help other kids that were in similar situations as me and were struggling in late middle school years. Yeah, it's building a lot of team skills and social skills to make them a lot more comfortable in hard years.
The Stratton Foundation has been an important player in the high school's success program since its beginning and is also involved in the Taconic and Green program, said Tammy Mosier, its executive director.
Yeah, we've been supporting the Burn Burton Success Program since about 2012. And we've been encouraging Burn Burton for a couple of years to expand the program to the other schools. And just, I think it's 2 years now that we have welcomed the seventh and eighth graders in their transition in the middle school and up to Burn Burton Academy. And feel that, you know, putting the success program mantra and the teachings and the support system around the younger kids will only make them stronger when they get to the high school level. And when it's a movement from elementary to middle school or middle school to high school, having the children at a younger age develop a sense of community, confidence to move through the school, and just have a support system at a younger age can only, you know, give them a drive to even want to go to school on a daily basis. Especially through our mentorship program, kids are encouraged to do well in school. They're giving tutoring support. So at a younger age, kids are really able to value their education and wanting to go to school.
Jason Pergament, who directs the Burn Burton Success Program, talked about the similarities between the two.
Oh, I mean, there's a lot of similarities. Differences, obviously, are the age cohort. The middle schoolers need a much more intense focus on getting along and peer connections and that kind of stuff. Whereas hopefully the high schoolers are getting to a point where they're really more considering career and college and academics. So we actually worked with Taconic and Greens to write a grant a few years back to secure funding for this through the Stratton Foundation. And then we worked with Serena to kind of get the program off the ground. And we're already this year, Billy and I, in our camp that we just completed, the success camp here at BBA, we had a really good cohort, just a group of kids that were really open and receptive. I would say that their peer relations, which is the focus of this work, is improving peer relations amongst these guys. We had no interpersonal conflict among the campers in camp this summer, which is remarkable in itself. So I think we're already seeing some of the results of the work that's being done with the middle schoolers in the success program, and then how they translate into being more ready for the high school experience.
But the Taconic and Green Success Program doesn't end with the summer camp. It provides a year-round structure for the students. During the school year, the students continue to meet on a regular basis in small groups, participating in a variety of activities and events designed to build self-confidence in a team environment. And there's always more to come. At some point this fall, the middle schoolers will take on the high ropes course. Clearly an example of going to the next level. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.TV.